Welcome to the Land Jam Podcast, a semi-friendly discussion between two blokes on watches, cars, and everything in between. Now, here are your hosts, Tommy and Sanjeev.
Welcome to the Land Jam Podcast, episode 39, the other Apollo-era space chronographs.
Yeah, so today is actually a pretty special episode. We both have a new watch to discuss. Double watch alert. And it's a double space watch alert. And it's a double Apollo era space watch. So it's very, very specific for the theme. But I mean, for me, you know, it's the Seiko Pogue. If you've been following the Instagram, you've definitely noticed a lot of Pogue activity. That's thanks to me. And Sanj, you've got a special pickup as well.
Yes. So I have the Bulova Moonwatch.
Wow. Okay.
So yeah, it was a nice gift. And I was totally unexpected. But yeah, I'm in ownership of the other Moonwatch, you know.
Finally. I would say, I mean, at least you've got a space watch now, finally.
I've always had a space watch.
We always have to bash Fortis on this podcast. There's no way around it.
Why?
The hubcap. So, okay, before we jump into Bulova, we'll do one after the other. So, you know, for people who, I don't think there's any real, you know, watch aficionados who are listening to the podcast and don't know what a Seiko Pogue is. But if they don't, you know, if you're that one person, you know, the Seiko Pogue really is the reference 6139-6002. You know, just to rewind, and we've discussed this, in 1969, three companies released the first automatic chronograph, one of which was Seiko, that released the 6139 movement. Seiko, you know, has that claim to be potentially the first mass-produced automatic chronograph movement, beating the other two competitors. So, you know, when it was released, the 6139 6000 series came in three colors. It came in this specific case design, this cushion case design. It came in blue, silver, and of course the gold dial, which is, you know, become the Pogue. Its foray into space, obviously, justifying this whole discussion, happened on Skylab 4. In 1974, when Colonel William Pogue, a pilot during the mission, sported a Seiko 6139-6002 gold dial alongside his Omega Speedmaster. Pogue was in the astronaut rotation for actually the canceled Apollo 19 mission. So this is why we're calling it an Apollo-era space watch. It's not an Apollo watch, obviously, it's post-Apollo. But Skylab itself was, you know, Apollo equipment.
It was launched on a derivative of the Saturn V rocket, right?
It was a shorter rocket. It was missing a stage or two.
I think you're right. Yeah, it was not the full three-stage setup.
Correct. If you've seen pictures of it, I think it sits on like a platform as it launches. But it was actually one of the stages of the Apollo rocket was Skylab itself. They hollowed out a stage and basically put an orbital lab in that stage. So it was really about using what was left over from Apollo as efficiently as possible. So that you know, was the birth of the Skylab program as a whole. And obviously, you know, in the astronaut rotation, if Apollo continued, this would have been Apollo 19. So that's why Pogue was on that mission. You know, history has it that Pogue bought the, you know, 6139 chronograph for $71 on June 13th, 1972. And he actually auctioned off the watch in 2008 for $5,975, which I think is incredibly low considering how famous the watch is.
Yeah, the provenance of the watch and the history.
The provenance of the watch. I have a, you know, I'm not an expert with you know, these kind of auction sales, but I can't imagine a watch like that, you know, the Colonel Pogue would sell for anything less than $20,000-$30,000 today.
Well, I mean, okay, so let's just put a small pin on that and let me interrupt a second. You and I have been looking at 6139s and we've seen Pogues a few years ago, right? On eBay for around $200.
Yeah.
Like just recently, maybe 2 years ago or so, like we've seen prices of these 6139s skyrocket.
skyrocket. It absolutely,
pun intended.
Yeah. yeah. It's jumped a lot. You know,
yeah, I cannot see this being sold for $6,000 in today's.
I can't. And the irony is, it's because the Pogue story became more famous, right? And you know, in the late 2000s, where it really picked up that people knew what this model was, that the secondary resale value for the other watches went up. But ironically, you know, the original watch itself, you know, $6,000 is really not that much for a space flown watch with this kind of provenance and this kind of a diehard following. So, you know, just to go back to what the model specifically is, you know, the 6139 gold dial line, there's a lot of different references and variations, right? And this is what's called the Pogue. But, you know, technically, you know, the Pogue is the 6002 reference number. It includes text at 9 o'clock referencing water 70 meters resist. That's the actual Pogue chronograph dial layout. There are versions without the lettering. You know, there's all kinds of diversity within the Seiko Pogue line, even just within the gold dial. But, you know, that's the actual specific Pogue. It should say water 70 meters resist. There's also, you know, water 70 meters proof, which was in the early production models. And then, you know, they went into the resist language. And in some cases, no text at 9 o'clock at all, which is the case with my Pogue. You know, very quickly for people to visually get an idea, it's a 40 millimeter case, 19 millimeter lug width. It's what's called a C-shaped case design, you know, cushion case, very pure 1970s chronograph. It doesn't get more 70s chrono than that. You've got two pushes for the chrono, and the crown has a quick day-date set. When pushed into place, it rotates the inner rotating bezel as well. So once the crown is in, you can actually rotate the inner rotating ring using the crown.
Interesting. Okay.
So the crown has a lot of functions. It can set the time, the inner rotating bezel, and you can set the day-date. In my experience, the day-date's a little finicky. So basically, you push for the date, and then you really push harder for the day-date. And then in my example, you can get that, but you can't really hit the day date multiple pushes. Like it kind of sticks after a while.
Pushes.
So you actually push it in, and it's really, really like kind of a sick feeling, right? When you push the crown in,
right?
You know, it's very counterintuitive because obviously you pull the crown out to do things, you know, in other watches. In this case, pull the crown out to set the date, push the crown in to pull the crown out to set the time, push the crown in lightly, let's say half pressure for the date, and then full pressure for the day date. So it's a little bit kind of unnerving doing that. For me, the first time I kind of like read and reread online how to do it because I was sure I was going to break it, but no, right. I mean, it works perfectly fine. In my experience, it's better to basically walk it close to midnight and you want to walk in the day first, and then setting the date is much easier. You do a light tap and you can get there pretty quickly. You know, visually, the outer tachymeter is Pepsi style, which is really eye-catching, right? Because you got that gold dial and then you've got red for the first 15 in the tachymeter and the you know, up till 3 o'clock, and then the remainder in blue. So it really pops.
Yeah, to see a watch with this kind of contrast with the bezel and the dial and color choice.
Yeah, it's really, really attractive and really kind of unique and eye-catching, which I think is why the Pogue is in some ways really, really popular. It also has a lot of depth in the dial. So like, you know, if you look at the you know, the hour markers are applied. They're not printed on the dial. So there's a lot of visual depth, the way the light plays with the markers. It's really eye-catching. It's really, really attractive. My watch came with a reproduced tapered H-link. Mm-hmm. So each link looks like the letter H. Very comfortable one sized, you know, it fits really well. It's really, really, it's a vintage feel to it, but it's not very jingly jangly. It is solid. But one complaint I have with it is it's a bit of a hair puller, you know, which is par for the course for kind of that era you know, bracelets. So if you're interested in getting a Pogue, you know, you should check out the article by thespringbar.com. They've done a really, really deep dive into basically the whole 6139-600X series guide. So that's not just the Pogue, but it's every, you know, the silver and the blue dial as well. And, you know, in any direction, if, you know, in any colorway, there's so much variety within that line because, you know, the Seiko Corporation made a lot of minor changes when it comes to the dial, the language, the movement. There are two types of movement. Even the inner rotating disc also comes in different colors. It's an Australian version of the Pogue, which has a black disc, which is, I got to say, pretty cool as well, you know? So there's a reason I think a lot of vintage Seiko collectors have multiple 6139, you know, Pogue style watches, because they come in such a diverse line. It's pretty easy to kind of jump into that rabbit hole and just kind of want to collect. So, I mean, that's the story of the Pogue. You know, I think it's very popular among Seiko vintage collectors. It's storied. It's a diverse line. And, you know, you don't have to stop with the Pogue either. You know, you've got the 6139-600X, you know, world, but you've also got the whole other world of 6139 chronographs. You know, you can take a look at the there's a great Japanese Air Force chronograph from the 70s with the same movement but a completely different case design. Very attractive. There's also one that was, you know, called the Bruce Lee. Bruce Lee wore a 6139 chronograph in many photos, you know, his personal watch, and also highly collectible.
Some of them do come out as like sport timer watches, right? Like they have a Seiko sport timer.
They use the moniker speed timer.
Speed timer, I'm sorry.
Yes. And this is technically part of that line. So let me double check if specifically.
Like I know there's like a 6139 in the same dial format, but in black. And I believe it has a speed timer written on it.
Yeah. There's a Coke Pogue, they call that. And that's called the, you know, they have that Seiko's speed timer moniker on that as well. So there's a whole, I mean, I'm trying to make it a little high level here for listeners, but there's no way I can convey that kind of detail to the average listener. I would really recommend to check out thespringbar.com. I'll put a link on it, but you know, they do great guides to vintage watches, and their kind of deep dive into the 6139 line is mind-blowing because there is so much going on. So you know, just personally, to give you some background on mine, you know, mine is definitely a vintage Pogue that in my opinion has to have been refinished in some way, shape, or form. The dial is in too good shape. I know the movement has been serviced, but I think it's a reproduction dial because there's no splotches or anything like that on it. There's no signs of age.
Yours is like flawless.
Flawless. It's like right out of the factory floor, it looks like. And the inner ring, a lot of the yellow rings, you know, the classic Pogue rings would bleach over time and turn white. From solar radiation, you know, over the decades. Mine is, you know, pristine yellow. So, you know, I think a lot of these are aftermarket parts, but I think it was really done by somebody who knew what they were doing and did it really tastefully. So, you know, I'm not upset. You know, if anything, there's less to complain about. I've got a pretty pristine Seiko Pogue. I would just say...
Yeah, I mean, it's something that will run for the foreseeable future without any problems and will aesthetically keep you entertained. Like, yes, you know, some collectors look for like the spiderweb dial cracking on like a Rolex sub, right? Like it adds value for some reason. To me, I'm like, that's a bit much.
Yeah, you know what I'm saying? Or the tropical dial on the Speedmaster, you know, the brown. I mean, it doesn't bother me, but yeah, you know, but this one, you know, I've got a new lease on life. Like, it's good for another 50 years. I mean, that's kind of how I think about it.
Not shining, like, light on the Pogue to get the tropical look, right?
No, I'm not. I'm not that deranged. But yeah, I mean, I think it's a great place to look if you're into vintage chronographs, but like, you know, I have to give a word to the wise, right? Like, there's a lot of Frankenpogues out there. There are a lot of unscrupulous, you know, guys in the industry who buy vintage watches and they'll mix and match dials and hands and, you know, whatever. You know, I got pretty lucky that the guy that worked on my Pogue kind of knew what he was doing and produced something that was faithful to the model and came out looking really well. But, you know, I have to warn you that you really should do your homework before you buy, and you should ask a lot of questions and kind of see, you know, if the seller is someone that you can kind of count on to, you know, to get you something accurate. What you don't want really is kind of a hodgepodge.
Yeah. It's really question the sellers who are selling these watches. Like, why are you putting a Doxa bezel on a Seiko Samurai? You know, like, buy it, sell it, like those, beware.
Yeah, sick people. Yeah, really, really sick people. So, yeah, I mean, that's the Seiko Pogue. You know, I do think it's one of the more sought-after Seiko vintage chronographs from that
era.
Yeah,
it's, like, really picked up, like, the 6139s and the 6138s. Like,
it's the Pogue story, you know, it's the Pogue story. Where else could you get a space-flown chronograph for a couple $100? Just, you know, for reference sake, my particular example was about $600-something, which I was... You know, I would say at that price range, it's enough to be serious about it and ask questions. But also, you know, you're not getting a $50 Pogue and kind of rolling the dice. Like, you know, at that stage, it better look like it's accurate and in good shape. You know, it's not something that you should accept any, you know, flaws with it. So, yeah. And look, you know, there's a guy that sold it to me that I believe he's refinishing Pogues in the same fashion and selling them. I think he has another example on eBay. So if you're in the market for a Pogue, you know, message us on Instagram at the Land Jam Pod and let me know, and I'll connect you to that guy on eBay. I'm happy to do that. I think, you know, as far as my
the Pogue broker,
yeah, as far as my example goes, it was fantastic. So I have nothing but good things to say about this gentleman and his work.
Awesome. Well, I mean, the first thing is I'm glad you felt that's right, because you've been looking for 6139s and 6138s, but you know, it somehow steered towards the Pogue, right?
Absolutely.
So I'm glad.
Yeah. I mean, it's a space connection, you know, for sure. I mean, I have a 6138-8020, the John Player Special, and that was the racing connection. So, you know, I'm just checking a box here. That's the way I see it.
So you have the Speedmaster Pro, you have the 6139 Pogue, and what's next? Is in 142?
I won't lie and say I haven't looked. I've definitely looked, but it's just a little pricey right now. In all honesty, to stay on theme, I'm sure you're going to be annoyed when I say this or roll your eyes, but I really like that new Seiko Solar Speed Timers. I think they look great. You know, the blue dial. Have you seen them? You
sorry, know was that right? was that captured? Because if so, I'm glad it is.
Son of a gun! Yes, it was. but you know, I think they're really attractive, and I think thematically the blue one really harkens back to the speed timers of yesteryear, you know, automatic chronograph one. So,
but that's not a true space watch, right? I mean,
no, not a space watch at all. I'm saying it thematically would follow the speed timer line.
True. I'm just trying to frame your.
I think for now, until I get a really good deal on a Zen, I think that's laid to rest.
Okay.
Yeah. That's
interesting that is. Well, that you and I have two space watches each.
Yeah, well, yeah. And, you know, mine are both very famous storied examples, kind of the exemplar space watches, the really iconic stuff. And
I choose with the underdogs.
What do you have? I'm not sure.
The obscure... Well,
let's talk about the second one. This is a good segue, Sam. So what's your... Apollo era chronograph.
So the one it's actually called the officially called the Bulova Lunar Pilot, but everyone calls it the Bulova Moonwatch because it was the only other watch, apart from the Speedmaster, that was used on the moon. And there's
physically
some,
landing on the moon.
Yes, landing on the moon and actually literally doing EVAs on the moon with this watch.
Correct. Yeah, because I think some of the command module pilots had Rolexes. I'm not caring.
I think Michael Collins did rock a. Did he rock a Rolex?
I thought the command module pilot on Apollo 13 had a Rolex as well as a Speedmaster.
Jack Swigert, right?
Jack Swigert. I don't quote me on that, and don't send me hate mail. But this is my faulty memory telling me that he had one, but didn't land on the moon technically. So. You're right. The Bulova is the one that did that. Except,
yes, and there's a correct, and there's a very special story about it. It was all by accident, to be honest with you. But some history on the watch. Like I said, the reference that was used on the moon was reference 88510/01. So back in the Apollo missions, there was some resentment by some in the community. Because, NASA chose a Swiss maker as the official wristwatch supplier for the Apollo missions, which was Omega. So, like, some were saying, this is the American, American mission. It should be worn head to toe in American gear. So there was some friction there. But officially, it was Omega that was chosen and used successfully. Bulova at the time was 100% American, and they somehow wanted to get a piece of the action in some way or some form, and they already had some relationship with NASA. Apparently, and every chronometer or time, I guess some sort of timing device in the Apollo capsules was actually made by Bulova, and that was supposedly used with their Accutron mechanism, which uses the tuning fork vibrating.
Yep. Yep.
And which the operated on much higher frequency.
Astronaut was the tuning fork, memory serves me right, the wristwatch that we talked about last episode.
Yes, the Bulova Accutron, yep.
Interesting little history tidbit. I think the chairman of Bulova at the time was General Omar Bradley from the Second World War, who commanded George Patton. Yeah. And he was one of the people at the forefront demanding that American astronauts on the moon wear an American wristwatch. So... he was part of that lobbying process.
Interesting. I did not know. But so obviously Bulova lost to Omega, but they gifted astronaut David Scott a prototype watch, which he decided to take up with him as a backup watch for Apollo 15. The connection was made through a friend, and the corporate of Bulova asked Scott to kind of evaluate this prototype. Yeah. So as the mission scope grew in complexity as they were preparing for the mission. One of the things they tried to do is to find redundancies and the tools they were using and in procedures that they were using. And because they were doing EVAs, which were, basically whether it's going on the rover or just doing excursions away from the lunar module, the complexity grew and grew to the point where they actually had to possibly use their watch as a way to measure their vitals. So they needed to add a redundancy, which was a backup watch. So Scott decided to use the Bulova as a backup to minimize any point of failure in this whole exercise process. So I think they were supposed to do three. But basically what happened was, obviously Apollo 15 was successful in landing on the moon and all. But at some point during, I think they called it EVA 2, the crystal of the Omega Speedmaster popped off. And I don't know how it really happened. And I don't think David Scott knew how it really happened, but it did. So basically rendered the watch useless.
I think they spotted a certain Sanjeev you know, from the Land Jam podcast with the screwdriver before launch.
It was my ancestors.
Popping off crystals. Basically popping off crystals.
they were lobbying for Fortis to get on the action. You know?
That's right. That's right. Yeah, yeah.
Like, okay, you know what?
So it popped off. Yeah.
I came in, just, you know, slightly lifted the crystal a bit much.
Yeah.
Some were saying whether, you know, if his hand, like, you know, scraped against one of the edges of the lunar modules, some are saying that it may have not passed or may have just popped off due to the thermal changes that were occurring on the moon. Okay. But no one, I don't think there was a real reason. You know, if there was and you have accurate information, obviously, please do let us know. So he did have the prototype below of a moon watch, and he used it successfully. Now, yes. This is where it gets really interesting. The Bulova Moonwatch, since it was a gift to the astronaut David Scott, it was entirely his watch, because all the Omega Speedmasters given to the astronauts during the missions were government property, so they had to give them back. So basically, his watch was the only private, non-government issued watch that was on the moon.
That's crazy. Yeah. Wow. Mm.
So back in 2015, the watch went up for auction and it was sold for $1.625 million.
That's crazy. Compare that to the Pogue.
Yeah.
Well, I guess the Pogue wasn't a moon landing watch, but still, yeah.
I mean, it's
that's a huge difference. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Like, this is a true moon watch.
Yeah.
So, yeah, a very interesting story. I try to get find more detail as to the specs of the original Moonwatch.
Yeah.
But it was very scarce. But if you notice the prototype, it looks very similar to the Omega Speedmaster. And that was on purpose, because it allowed less time for the astronaut, or Dave Scott, basically, since he's the only one that wore it, to get acclimatized to the format and the operation of the watch.
Yeah, it was intentional. Yeah,
it was totally intentional.
Just to be clear, this watch was an automatic chronograph or a mechanical chronograph of some kind.
It was a mechanical chronograph.
It was it wasn't. It wasn't a quartz at all, right?
I don't think so. But I try to find the movements.
I know for a fact it wasn't. I'm trying to find the actual original movement, but. I'm having a little bit of trouble actually finding that. But,
same here.
But as far as the watch that you got,
yes,
so the reissue,
yes, the reissue I think was kind of brought back, I think, a few years ago in 2017 or 2016.
Yeah,
it's a faithful representation. Maybe not in terms of the watch case size, because this is a 45 millimeter watch, case,
yeah.
And it is fairly a large watch. And the other thing is, it is not a mechanical watch. This is a high-frequency proprietary Bulova quartz watch.
Yep.
But the frequency operates at 262 kilohertz, which is basically like 8 times the frequency of a normal quartz watch. So what does that mean? It kind of looks like a mecha quartz on, like, you know, your Newmark, for example.
Yeah.
So the second sand, which the second, let's say, that's on the 6 o'clock subdial, which shows the seconds for just regular timing, it kind of moves a little bit like an automatic watch. But when you activate the chronograph, it's very smooth.
Gotcha.
Tell.
It approximates it. Got it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so you get kind of the aesthetic visual feel of the an automatic watch or mechanical watch.
Yeah.
But the precision is rated at about like plus or minus 10 seconds per year.
Yeah.
So highly accurate. So you have, like, you know, like the moon watch or even the Omega, you have three subdials. So I already mentioned the 6 o'clock. The 3 o'clock is basically 1/10 of a second subdial. So it measures the time and broken up into a second. So it rotates every second, a full 360 degrees. And then the 9 o'clock is basically like a minute counter, so which goes up to an hour.
Mm.
So there's some useful functionality. There's a date at about 4:30. And just like your Pogue, the indices are applied, so it's got some depth to it. And there's also a little bit of depth in the sub-DAOs as well. So it's a very it does look like an Omega Speedmaster, but there's some subtle differences that you can easily spot out when you.
I think it's a really attractive design. I like the case design as well. You're right. It looks exactly like a Speedmaster, and that's accurate because that's what Bulova did intentionally. So that original Speedmaster kind of dial layout, which is really attractive and iconic, is kind of fairly used here. So
Exactly.
no one's stealing anything from anybody. This was the point. And I think because it has that high frequency quartz and that smooth sweep, a lot of the bugaboos with quartz is kind of mitigated. I mean, how would you even know unless someone told you? I mean, how would you know? And you were looking really closely and seeing that it kind of stutters and
Yeah.
doesn't sweep.
The
It's
closest thing
difficult
you
to
can,
tell.
yeah. The second hand of the 6 o'clock sub dial, it does. It's like in between, like a classic quartz watch and an automatic. So it's not really smooth. But when you run
Bit of a stutter
the
instead of a sweep.
yeah, yeah. But when you run the chronograph, the sub dial, it does operate in the same manner. But the chronograph hand is basically running like a what you might call it. An automatic watch or a mechanical watch.
The interesting thing is the pushers.
Yes, I was going
They're
to get to
not
that.
traditional.
So the pushers, I guess, which what separates, I guess, the design a little bit from the Omega is these is more of instead of a classic round pushers, you got these rectangular pushers, which are a bit slimmer in profile. But I guess it's I don't know if it makes it easier to activate or not. But the feel of it is kind of like a classic mechanical watch. So
It
it's
looks
got that.
really cool. It looks like a really cool evolution of that Speedmaster design. I'm looking at it now and I'm like, oh man, that's kind of a unique variation. Like I could see Speedy fans like want to get a Bulova, just to kind of augment the collection with something kind of like a variation of that design. Sizing, I've read online that people complain that the Bulova Moonwatch is a bit too big. How
It
did
is
it
a bit big.
how does it weigh
Yeah,
on you?
that's one of the drawbacks. So if I thought my Fortis was thick, this is just as thick. And for two reasons. So like if you look at the lug to lug length, it's I think it's about 52 millimeters. It's a bit big on my wrist.
52 lug to lug.
I think so.
Wow.
And the other thing is the thickness. You really don't notice it, but when you kind of pay close attention, so the crystal kind of pops out a little bit. And you got a little bit of the thickness of it looks like a pretty thick crystal. And like I'm like super nervous sometimes because like because this part of the crystal is exposed. And I don't want to like chip this thing.
It's a sapphire
It's sapphire
crystal.
crystal, yeah. And it's got an anti-reflective coating. I don't think it's
It's
double anti-reflective.
it looks really attractive. Did yours what did yours come in a bracelet or what was
No, mine
the
came in a leather strap, and that's the other complaint I have. So you get, I don't know if you get it with when if you choose for the bracelet. I'm pretty sure you do, but you get a NATO strap. I haven't switched it to a NATO strap just yet, but the leather strap, I think you have to work really hard to wear it in.
I gotta
So
say, it looks really good on the bracelet.
yes, it does look good in the
It
bracelet,
looks
but
like a really cracking watch.
I think in the new year I'm going to switch it to and the nylon NATO strap that it comes with. That'll definitely improve the comfort.
Nice. I like
There's
it a
some,
lot. I like it a
yeah,
lot,
no,
Sanch. I think it's really attractive.
the back of the watch has got, I guess, some sort of engraving if it's engraved, I believe. Yes, and it talks about the day that was, Apollo 15, July 26, 1971 to do August 7, 1971, and the specific mission it was used on, which was EVA3, August 2, 1971.
Awesome. I think it's great. It's a really nice touch. Since the original release of the Lunar Pilot, there have been variations on it. I think they've had an all black variation.
Yes, there's like a PVD coated one. There's like a 50th anniversary one, which is in both
Which
gold.
is gold. Which I thought was pretty cool as well. So it's pretty cool that, Bulova has their own kind of, Moonwatch line, and they're kind of iterating on special editions and that sort of stuff
So,
themselves.
yeah,
So
and the price point, it's you can get it for like $500.
that's, it's really not bad. And I think, I don't know. I'm going to be mocked for saying this. I own a Speedmaster. I love the Moonwatch. I think it's fantastic and obviously iconic and, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But if a Moonwatch is kind of out of financial reach or just not a priority right now, I really think the Bulova hits a lot of those points. You kind of get a similar visual appeal, and it does have space provenance. It may not be the
Exactly.
same exact movement, but so what? Bulova is put in a really high performance coarse movement in there.
And
There's
the watch is
nothing.
made with, very solid construction. I'm surprised. Yeah, it is a quartz, I get that, but I'm surprised it's priced at that price point in a good way because it's a really well put together space watch. Like
Is the height of it related to being a high performance quartz, or why is that, right? You would expect a quartz movement to be fairly thin. You don't need to.
that's the surprising thing. I
I
mean,
don't get it. I don't get why they do that. I mean, Bulova has a habit. So, Bulova is no longer an American company. It is owned by, I think, Citizen, right? It's a
I
Citizen
think
watch group.
so.
And these guys are infamous for oversizing their watches. I don't know why they do it. They made some really strange decisions with sizing. Your experience confirms that for their Moonwatch as well. I really wish they would kind of tone it down and kind of make it a bit more, manageable.
It doesn't look like a big watch, but when
It
you wear it, it
doesn't. I'm
does.
looking at pictures and it looks just like, scale wise, like a Speedmaster. I don't see what the difference is, but you're not the first person to complain about the size, which doesn't surprise me. But yeah, I like this version a lot. Actually, in 2017, they had an all black version, which I think is really, really cool as well. But if you're trying to kind of get that Moonwatch feel, you got to go for the steel like you did. I think that's the way to go.
Yeah, I mean, like I always tell people this, if I were to buy a quartz watch, I would get a moon watch, the Bulova moon watch. And to be fair, like it's like what you said about the Newmark when we reviewed it. It doesn't look or act like a Bulova. I mean, sorry, like a quartz watch. It looks more like an automatic or a mechanical
Agreed.
watch.
Agreed. Agreed. All right, Sanj. So very exciting for both of us. Two new space watches. Let's get it in the rotation,
Yeah, that's right. By rotation, you mean this is a very formal and very subtle way of saying put some pics on the Instagram account.
Exactly. So, folks, you heard it here first. Sign the change.org petition to get Sanj to put some photos of his watches
You
on
know
the
what? I've
Instagram
made it a
account.
New Year's resolution just for you, Tommy.
Okay, so follow through on this, okay?
Yes.
Okay, so very good. All right, so let's switch on to what you're buying, Sanj. I think we've both got two interesting picks here. Mine is actually a Bulova. Mine is another Bulova release. The actual Mill Ships submersible automatic dive watch. It is akin to those series of watches we've talked about, the Tornik Ravel
Yeah, that's
or
right.
Oh, what's the
We did do the shoot.
Squale
This is
did
old age
one
kicking in.
variation of it as well. I'm Blancpain, Jesus.
Blancpain,
I'm
that's right. I knew it was
losing my
starting with a
mind.
B. I'm
I'm
like,
losing my mind.
what is it?
It's all, it's the same case design. The Tornik Ravel, the Blancpain, Squale, and now Bulova has their own prototype, I believe historical prototype that they're bringing. out to the fore. And obviously they all look alike because they all have to look alike because they were designed by the same government department. And basically
it was built for a specification, right? Like they had to follow
a requirement. Exactly. It's kind of like the Dirty Dozen, how they all kind of look alike, even though you've got different people producing the watch. There's even, you know, less variation here, if you ask me. Anyway, long story short, the Bulova version of that, the Mill Ships, is on sale at Zales for
$895.
Okay, so when okay, this is for the listeners, a little peek behind the making of an episode. So when I put the notes together for this episode about 3 weeks ago, it was on sale for $626.50. All right. You've got your friend Sanjeev to thank for the current sale price of $895.
Now, let me put a twist on that. Blancpain, didn't they ever do a release? I think, wasn't it with Hodinkee?
Maybe.
We yeah. covered it.
Okay.
We covered it a few episodes ago. And they were selling it, what was it, for $6,000?
Yes. Don't do that. I mean, this, if you want to, if you can afford it. Yeah, I mean, you can even get the Tornik Ravel, which I think is by the same guys that do Mark II watches, for pre-order for $845.
Yeah, so basically, like, you're getting basically the same specs.
The same watch, yeah. It's it is what it is. What do you got, Sanj? What's your...
Well, I mean, so I'm looking at this watch. Pick? A, it's a very attractive watch, hands down. B, I think you have the common complaint, like, if you look at the side of the watch, it's a pretty thick watch again.
Yes, yes. No, it sits on the wrist. I'm not sure the actual specifics on how high it is. I would recommend you try one on before you buy it. It may not be as high as it looks, but
yeah,
I don't know. Yeah, what's your watch of buying picks?
The one I'm gonna talk about is listed on Amazon. And it's by Laco or Leco.
Yeah.
And it's basically the Leco Type B Flieger watch, which is, I believe the reference is 861690. And this one's particular is a 42 millimeter iteration. Leco has like a few of them, like in 39, I think maybe even 36, but they even go up to 55.
Wow. Which is accurate. I've seen, you know, historical photographs of German bomber pilots during the Battle of Britain, and one of the guys has a huge watch on the outside of his jacket, of his
front Correct. Jacket. I mean, you have to understand, like, back in the day, right, the instruments were very, very plain and simple. Like, there were nothing of high-tech quality or anything of that. I mean, it was basically a few dials, but they really had to rely on their watch for timings, right? And we talked about it, you know, during the first few episodes of the podcast about...
We did an episode on Fliegers. Yeah, if memory serves me right. If eagle-eared listeners can go back to the feed and find it, we took a deep dive on the difference between Type A, Type B. Laco, I believe, is one of the original providers.
Correct. And so that's what makes it...
getting a watch with provenance, yeah.
Exactly. It was one of the providers. So, in a sense, like, yeah, they know what they're exactly doing when they release this.
That's Type right, B. folks. If you really want to dress like a Nazi fighter pilot, this is the way to go on a budget.
Oh boy, there we go.
I mean, that's the history. What do you want me to do about it?
Oh boy, what's next? Volkswagen Beetle.
Hey, you said it, not me.
And what's next? U.S. space program built on German blood.
Yeah. Again, you know, you said it, not the Werner von Braun. This is all old news.
Okay.
You know, nobody's learning anything new here. Yeah. So this Let's one has the Miyota movement in it, right?
Yes, it has a Miyota movement. So it's a pretty, you know, pretty mass-produced movement. Nothing fancy about it, but it's a well-constructed, well-made watch made in Germany, and it's available for $378.
There we go. That's a really good price for that model.
This particular model got upgraded with the sapphire crystal. That was one thing.
Very nice. Very nice. So, I think it's very simple. It's very clean. I think
You prefer the Type A design more than Type B, right?
I do. And my issue with the Flieger really is that leather, you know, with the buttons or the riveting, it's just never been a thing for me. And I also find that kind of I'm bashing this right now, but the case design is kind of boring to me. But you know, if you like it, get it. I think it's cool. It's just not for me.
So hard to please the guy. What's actually interesting is the case back. It is a clear case back, like yeah. Sapphire clear.
Display case back.
Yeah, yeah, there is some finishing to this movement. I mean, it's not like high end or anything like that, but for $378, someone's actually done something to make it. Like the rotor has got some engraving and some finishing, and it's got some striped finishing on some of the parts. So it's, you're getting quite a bit of a deal, actually.
There you go. All right, Sanj. I think we've given people two interesting watches to look at for watch you're buying.
Yours covered the sea. Mine covered the air.
There you go. So off to closing notes?
Yeah, let's do it.
So my two closing notes are Japan related and quite different. So one is actually about a pretty crazy story that Ars Technica covered regarding Toyota owners who kind of woke up to find out that they have to pay $8 a month to keep using their key fob for remote start.
Yeah, it's quite like bizarre yet like frustrating yet not surprised from my.
They're making it a subscription model. You know, I'm old enough to remember back in the 90s where it was just a button on your keychain and you.
It's a radio frequency fob, all right.
Yeah, there's no reason for a subscription at all. But I don't know if the Toyota. I'd have to refresh my memory on how this specific system worked. I know my Subaru remote start is an app.
Yes,
yeah, Toyota's an app. Yeah.
So the way I think the remote start, the key fob on like the newer models is connected to the infotainment and its architecture. So in order for it to work, the infotainment or the architecture needs to recognize it as you're paying for it. Only then you'll be activated.
Gotcha.
So it's like
$8 a month.
Well, that was the plan. And recently, I think as of yesterday, day before, Toyota's reviewing this particular issue at hand. So
the backlash
has been huge. But it was apparently in like super fine print that this was gonna happen. So like depending on the model and what you had, like it was either lasted 3 years or 10 years if you had like a higher trim or something like that, like a premium audio.
And I mean, it's garbage regardless.
It's completely garbage. But like previous years, like before 2018 or anything like that, or behind a specific date, which was the 12th of November 2018, your key fob just worked fine, actually. And part of it was the chips that were being used in previously to November 12th and after November 12th. So the talk is that like previous ones had 3G chips. And it was not really connected to the services or the cellular networks because people were fading out 3G. So the newer ones are upgraded. So you can connect online and do the remote connect services and download what subscription service you want. So which is why they implemented. But it's becoming a common practice in the automotive industry.
Yeah, it's crap. Yeah.
I mean, they talk about like how you can.
Everybody wants recurring revenue. I
mean, exactly.
Basically, you know, this is the razor blade business, right? You give
the Silicon Valley free.
I mean, it's all kinds of businesses. It's razor blades are sold the same way, right? You get the handle for free from Gillette, but you pay through the nose the razor blades.
That's just like printers, you know, the other one.
Yeah, exactly. You know, DeskJet printers. So, you know, Toyota's. I'm glad there's been a lot of backlash because it's absurd in my opinion. But
I mean, nowadays, like, I'm not surprised because cars are being somewhat equipped, right? But they won't be activated because you have to activate it with a subscription service.
God help us. God help us.
You are surfed your own car.
That's right. All right. So the other Japanese related story is actually about a song. Okay. So the song is Maria Takeuchi's Plastic Love, which was a song that was released in 1984 as a 12-inch single. It only reached number 86 in the Japanese music charts. Right. So this is 1984. And that's it. That's where that song ended. Okay. 86. So it didn't go any higher than that. An extended version of the song was released on YouTube and went completely viral. And basically it was posted to a specific channel and it got over 24 million views. So many views that Warner Music basically re-released that single and actually did a new music video, specifically because the YouTube version of this song blew up so much, Warner Music had to do it. So, you know, more than, you know, 35 years since this song came out and nobody cared, you know, basically kids on YouTube who made the song go viral have forced Warner to re-release the song and also to give it the music video that it never got. So like if you watch the music video, like it looks like it's taking place in the 80s, like the clothes, the places they go to, you know, what they're doing. You wouldn't at first glance realize that this actually was released in 2021. But it's a pretty crazy story. Kotaku covered it pretty well. I really enjoy the song. It's called Plastic Love on YouTube. And it's also the streaming gold link as well. So check it out. You know, I think it's catchy. It's city pop. You know, you guys know I enjoy that kind of smooth, you know, kind of songs. So
I'm surprised it's not part of our, you know, you haven't replaced our theme song with city pop.
Well, you know, ironically, because it's popular now, we probably couldn't get away with the copyright strike.
So what you're trying to say is,
could have done it a year ago. Yeah.
We should re-release an episode 30 years from now and in hopes that it'll be a top 10.
It'll go viral. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Like COVID. Viral like COVID. That's what it would do.
You want it to be as viral as Omicron, all right?
That's right. All right, Sanj, what else you got for closing notes?
So this is kind of, at the time of this recording, very recent, as of a few hours ago, but it is talking about, it's a BBC article about Richard Marcinko, who was basically the founder of SEAL Team 6, and he has passed away at 81. And basically, he was a Vietnam War veteran and had more than 30 medals and citations during his career.
Yeah.
And he had a, I don't know much about his life and character. I believe he's written a book or worked on a book.
But yeah, it's called Rogue Warrior.
Character, basically, you know.
Yeah, he's pretty famous. He was kind of a big deal, and I think he led the specific SEAL team for like 3 years. The way I know him is actually through the video game Rogue Warrior, which came out for PS3, based on his book, the 1992 autobiography Rogue Warrior as well. So, you know, classic, I think it's a third person shooter, but that's how I'm familiar with the name. So when you said he passed away, I was like, oh, I've heard that name before. Really interesting guy, you know, controversial in some ways, but you know, really interesting.
Yeah. I mean, he's definitely recognized for his success in the military, but also, I guess his larger than life character also led him to some unfortunate post military career, you know, some government defrauding over but
alleged,
yeah.
I think he was convicted, so maybe not alleged.
Yeah, he was actually convicted, released after 15 months in prison. But like you said, Rogue Warrior was released in 2009 with Marcinko as the protagonist. Actually, voiced
Mickey Rourke, I think. Yeah, yes. Voiced, just crazy. Yeah, so they kind of look alike. Actually, now, you know, Mickey Rourke post surgery kind of looks like this guy, which is interesting. Cool.
But you know, you got to give him credit. You know, with his skill set and
as a founding commander, a particular set of skills.
Exactly.
All right. So, now he's gold.
Gonna lead me down this path to find out more about him and his life. So.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, start with the video game. Yeah. That's where any serious history is done. It's done through old PS3 video games. So get started. So Streaming Gold, as I mentioned, Mari Takeuchi's Plastic Love music video, result of a song going viral 35 years later. Check it out. I really enjoyed it. Very catchy song. And the other one is about the recently launched James Webb Space Telescope.
That's right. So the channel Real Engineering has done a phenomenal coverage on the engineering behind the James Webb Space Telescope. And it is incredible piece of engineering. Like, I'm so amazed at what its requirements are and what it's able to do and how they plan to make this mission achievable.
It's amazing. It's really historic. Interesting thing is that, you know, while Hubble is so famous, James Webb is actually going to be not anywhere close to low Earth orbit. It's going to be actually further away from than the moon is.
Right. It's going to be at Lagrange. They call it Lagrange point 2. So it's going to be like kind of like static in the sense that it's not going to be influenced by Earth's gravity.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about 1 million miles away from Earth.
Extraordinary stuff. It's also very complex how it's going to be unfolded over the next couple months into its final form.
Yes, it's apparently, I think, 300 points of failure that could happen with this unfolding. Insane.
And unlike Hubble, which did have a issue with the lenses that required, you know, basically an emergency spacewalk to fix, this is a one and done. You know, if anything happens to the space telescope, you know, before it's fully operational, it's not likely or, you know, next to impossible at this stage to send any space crew to go fix it.
Correct. So I mean,
it has to work. Yeah.
Yeah. I think the planned life is 10 years, if I remember correctly. And only because it's going to run out of fuel by then.
Do you know when planning began for this telescope?
I know it was a 10-year project. I don't know when.
No, it's longer than that.
I know, like, the planning. Yeah. So.
It began in 1996.
Wow.
They started planning for the James Webb Space Telescope. Someone said online that the Macarena was the number one song when they began working on the telescope. So
imagine spending 25 years of your life on this telescope.
Yeah, it's the worst ways to spend your life. Yeah.
It's crazy. I mean, knowing you for 25 years has been a whirlwind.
I haven't known you for 25 years, but it feels like an eternity. It definitely feels like an eternity.
But I highly encourage you to check out this video, but also other episodes of Real Engineering.
It's a great channel. A great channel. Yeah, I would second that. I hate to agree with Sanj, but I would second that. All right. Well, I think that this is a pretty solid episode, Sanj. Solid way to kind of see off the year to space pornographs.
And
get better than that.
One of the very few episodes that we you fully agree basically on all the things we've covered.
Yeah, I think the Belova moon watch is a unique update to a classic watch. It's really attractive.
If you can find a sweet Pogue, as long as the seller's legit, definitely go get one because it's a future. It's already a future classic, but it'll be even more of a future classic
now that it's going to come down to condition and provenance and that sort of thing. But you know, if you're okay with someone tastefully refinishing a Pogue, as mine is done, let me know and I'll connect you to the guy. All right. Well, I think we'll wrap it here. Thanks again for listening to another episode of the Land Jam podcast. Follow us on Instagram, follow us on Twitter. If you like this episode, share, tell a friend, and also review us on iTunes. It really helps us reach more audiences. So until next time.